episode 24 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We are lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government, and I'm joined today by our cast of regulars, Michael Battis, formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department, and now a partner in Steptoe's New York office, and Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where he oversaw criminal computer crime prosecutions, among other things, and is now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe. Our guest commentator and good friend today is Paul Rosenzweig, who's a principal at Red Branch Consulting and a distinguished visiting fellow at the Homeland Security Institute and an adjunct professor of law at GW Law School, all in the effort to live down his days as my second-in-command at the Department of Homeland Security Policy Office. And I have to say, to be a distinguished visiting fellow, I always liked that because I see, you know, only Congress would see me as honorable and only these think tanks would see me as distinguished. But
likewise, they trade you the name for money. They pay you less and they give you a better title.
The longer the title, the less you're getting paid.
This is a proportion, baby. Exactly right.
Okay, and I am Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS, and holding the record for returning to Steptoe to practice law more times than any other lawyer. I went to the Lawfare barbecue, and
the only place where
you can find more than two people who listen to this podcast, and one of them said, "So, what is the record?" And so I had to do the count. I have joined Steptoe and Johnson 5 times, and the last 3 of them, remarkably, for those who know me, required a 2/3 vote of the partnership, which I survived. So that's it. Let's
Derek, can I just interrupt you for a second? I think it's time to give me some due for my record of taking the longest to accept an offer from Steptoe, and that was 19 years between when I got an offer after my summer associate stint and when I finally joined the firm in 2005.
Yeah, that does suggest a little difficulty making up your mind. You had how many jobs in between? You were 2 or 3 jobs in government, and then you went up to Dartmouth.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't counted them. Probably 6 or 7 or 8. But I've been here almost 10 years. I don't know what's happened to me.
Yeah, well, children happened to you, I think.
good point.
I got my offer while driving down Connecticut Avenue in my car, but I accepted by the time the light turned green.
That's good, yes.
Is this pardon the interruption, or did I come to a law podcast?
Okay, so enough. Let me get back to the podcast.
Don't on my count.
Well, I was about to say that this week in NSA as a feature is hanging by a thread. I had actually written an intro saying there is no This Week in NSA, because nothing happened. The Snowdenista journalists have run out of ammo. And then a federal judge in San Francisco decided to issue an order, an interim order under a FOIA lawsuit brought by EFF to get access to 5 FISA court opinions. And the judge said, you know, I don't fully trust the government. I think the government has not been declassifying paragraph by paragraph in an appropriate way. They've been telling me it's all too sensitive. I want to see these 5 opinions in camera to make my own decision. So that is the only NSA news of the week, and so maybe next week we will get to say there is no This Week in NSA. That would be devoutly to be wished for.
Do you really think that they're out? the ammo's gone? That everything that is newsworthy in the broadest sense has been disclosed, and that Glenn Greenwald has nothing more up his sleeve?
Greenwald has said he has one more. He started to talk about a finale. Using fireworks show analogy, saying, well, you save the best for last, you want to go out with a big burst. And he has suggested that this is going to be a listing of Americans who have been intercepted by NSA, which would certainly be newsworthy. and you could get plenty of reaction from people on that. And remember, Snowden in his very first interview said, sitting at my desk, I can wiretap anybody. He's never actually demonstrated that that was true. This is his last chance. Maybe he has something that suggests that either he could or did go out and gather information on people, or that NSA was gathering it. He may have gotten access to the identities of people who were searching for in certain circumstances. So I think there's one more story that Greenwald's working on, but who knows when he'll do that. All right, well, let's talk about China, since that's what we were talking about before Snowden interrupted us. CrowdStrike put out a another report, sort of like the Mandiant report, a different unit of the PLA, Third Army, and similarly damning evidence. They got the name of the guy they think was running a lot of these intrusions. They have his picture. They have his blog. They have his girlfriend's picture. It appears that hacking U.S. companies is good for your love life. Lots of detail about exactly what he did, what his tactics were. Maybe in 6 months to a year or two, we'll see another indictment coming out of this. I thought that was interesting. But we also have a personal connection to that, because, Paul, I think you actually went and had lunch with the Chinese embassy to talk about cyber issues. You've been at least as outspoken as I have about Chinese hacking. How did that happen, and what did they say?
Well, it was really kind of surprising, because I would have thought I was kind of beneath their radar, but I got out of the blue an email, greetings from the Chinese embassy. We'd love to have you for lunch or tea.
They haven't already had you for lunch.
Well, yeah. I took counsel, with some colleagues, present and former members of, various agencies who strongly suggested that I not go to the embassy, nor have them to my office. So we met for lunch. And I took no electronics, and I took a colleague to kind of, take notes. And, altogether pleasant, as, so many encounters with the Chinese are, I'm sure. But it was really, surprising and in some ways, quite disturbing. The surprising portion of it was, how surprised they seemed by the indictments.
That's kind of gratifying.
It is. In this way. But I had the sense that they're searching for their answer to it, their next step, that it was, a change in U.S. tactics that they hadn't really anticipated. And so they were busy thinking about what to do. What was disturbing about it, which is, the same thing that's disturbing to most Americans in response to the Mandiant report, the indictments, the CrowdStrike report, is the kind of recalcitrant, it's not true, the refusal to deal with what to all of us who follow the evidence seems to be a pretty solid forensic case. Yeah, granted, it hasn't been tested in a court of law on a proof beyond a reasonable doubt standard, but anybody who reads the Mandiant report, anybody who reads the CrowdStrike report, anybody who reads the forensic details of the indictment, has little doubt that which we suspected 5 years ago is, and that was probably well known inside the intelligence community, is now beyond a shadow of a doubt known publicly. And yet, the nice fellow that I was speaking to had the, I want to say temerity, but said to me, you haven't shown us the evidence. If you show us the evidence, we'll take care of it. We'll fix it. We'll go investigate and stop these bad actors. But nobody's presented it to us. And I kind of gently said, I wasn't there, but I read in the Washington Post that National Security Advisor Donilon went over an entire delegation of military and intelligence community people and had an entire dossier there. He said, not enough, didn't show. So it's very disturbing because, of course, you really can't have a negotiation over a contentious issue with somebody who refuses to participate in the discussion, vel non.
Yeah, but we're not ready for a negotiation because we haven't got the tools to make them feel enough pain to want to negotiate.
Well, there's that. I mean, the flip of it, which was another interesting portion of it, was that his question for me was, what did I think the U.S. government would do next? Which was an interesting question, because, of course, if it's just an indictment that we throw on the table with nothing behind it, then it's an idle threat, you know, a meaningless gesture, perhaps something useful for signaling to our own people, but not really a part of a strategy to modify Chinese behavior. I hope, without any evidence, but I hope that it is, in fact, the first step in a strategic effort to ramp up the pressure and to manage the relationship with China in ways that generate a better response from them. We'll have to see. We'll have to watch for the next 6 months and see what the administration does.
You know, the indictment says these guys that we are indicting were working for certain state-owned enterprises that are not named. But the facts that are alleged would certainly support a conspiracy to violate the CFAA on the part of the state-owned enterprise.
Or RICO, or Racketeering Influence Corrupt Organization charge.
So I think it's got to be a little unusual, and maybe we can ask Jason or Michael, for there to be an indictment that mentions people by category, if not by name, as doing and being part of a criminal act, and doesn't indict them.
It's not that unusual. I mean, think of here in D.C.,
right?
Yeah, you think of here in D.C., mayoral candidate A, right, who we now know was Vince Gray. It typically is because you're on a preliminary stage and the next step is to get more evidence and indict mayoral candidate A.
That's what I think, too.
Or state-owned enterprise 1 and state-owned enterprise 2. I would think that that's also part of what should be the discussion between the United States and China in the next step, because those institutions,
they can't just decide to take their vacations
right, elsewhere. China. Those institutions, unlike the PLA members, do have interests outside of the borders and are subject to law.
I mean, you know, the DOJ's practice, and it's consistently followed, is not to name people in indictments by name who are not charged with a crime. That doesn't mean you have to make it impossible to figure out who they are.
Right.
And it's often the case that, given the nature of a crime, you know, it's not hard at all to figure out who the institution or individual is who's, you know, co-conspirator one, co-conspirator two. So they've certainly adhered to the letter of the rule by not naming them, but it didn't take much additional research for the press or others to figure out who they are.
So, they might choose not to indict somebody for any number of reasons, from not having the evidence to not being ready for the trial, because there will be a trial if they indict a state-owned enterprise. They'll have jurisdiction over those guys.
Or pretrial negotiations for a plea deal, which in this instance would not be a plea so much as a stand down maybe from the Chinese.
Well, I
doubt it, but, you know.
This is too valuable for China. This has been enormous.
I will say the other reason why the state-owned enterprises might have gotten off the hook is because that really ramps it up in a way that would probably drive Chinese retaliation. Because if there are state-owned enterprises that operate outside of China, there are American corporations that operate inside China who would be subject to all sorts of sanctions, whether criminal or civil, in ways that we might not be ready for either.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, the determination on the part of the Chinese government to disadvantage the U.S. tech sector in China is, as they say, overdetermined. There are dozens of reasons why they want to do that, and why they've already done as much as they think they can get away with now. Though I suppose criminal indictments would change everybody's view of the world who's doing business there, and maybe they could do that if they chose to.
Thus gives them some room to ramp up. You know, you go after the individual hackers as a first step, and it gives you somewhere to go.
That's right. That was always my assumption, is they got this out, and they had to get it through the interagency. This is what they took through the interagency, this allows them to go back in 2 or 3 or 6 months and say, okay, now Here's our encore.
I think the really interesting question is whether or not there are other components to the broader strategy that are whole of government answers. I mean, the criminal indictments are a piece of the puzzle. That's the law enforcement piece. But you can imagine all sorts of financial, economic, information warfare kinds of things, diplomatic efforts in a whole host of ways. If this is part of a bigger strategy, then it's a great first step. If it's just a step that nobody knows what's coming next, it's probably going to make them more angry than it's going to make them happy.
Then, it's only a strategy when you implement it. Right now, I'm sure it's a proposal by some and opposed by others to go on from here. Yeah, but they certainly have additional steps they could take. They could do OFAC sanctions on the individuals and move from there again without the necessity of a proof beyond a reasonable doubt or of declassifying the evidence.
World Trade Organization, maybe not. Actually, have I told you my favorite one? Break down the Great Chinese Firewall.
Oh,
start poking little holes in it. It's an information op. Obviously has to be covert, so we can't talk about it, except I can because I'm not part of the IC. But, what is the one thing that would actually get China's attention was anything that was a threat to regime stability.
So allowing the Dalai Lama to communicate more easily into China, for example.
My motto for this program is let 1,000 tweets bloom.
Huh. Yeah, that would certainly get people's attention. And oddly, I think that's something that the State Department has been much more supportive of than many of these other approaches. So you might get an unusual lineup in the interagency. Last little piece of Chinese news, or two, the House Armed Services and Senate Armed Services Committees are working on authorizing legislation. And as usual now, it's become standard to have some little tweak the Chinese measure, and they have some measures that I haven't yet seen, but I've seen described, which suggest that if you work for the intelligence community, you can't go to work for Chinese-influenced companies without special permission, a variety of other sort of slowly cutting off the ability of Chinese companies to play the game the way the rest of the industry plays it. I appreciate the irony here. There was, you remember, a private meeting in a private home to commemorate the 25th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacres. The Chinese have just announced the arrest of one of the attendees at that relatively small meeting, who's a human rights lawyer named Pu Zhenchang, I think. But the irony is they're going to send him to jail for 3 years for unlawfully collecting the private personal information of Chinese citizens. So I often warn that privacy law is mostly unintended consequences and good news for the rich and privileged. China is demonstrating that. I am waiting to hear any privacy group in the United States say, no, that's a misuse of privacy law. And I'm waiting to see the Article 29 Working Party of the European Union explain how their law couldn't possibly be used in this improper way.
I think we should send Peter Sharoff to defend him.
Yes, then. Good idea. That's a twofer. No. All right. On to a case which is both in the news and where we have a client interest. Microsoft has been resisting a Stored Communications Act warrant for data stored in Ireland. They lost before the magistrate who, in the usual magistrate form. Was delighted to be in the newspapers with such a hot issue, but it has been appealed. The decision has been appealed to the district court, and briefs are being filed. Microsoft filed a brief last week, and so did Michael Vattis on behalf of Verizon and in support of Microsoft. Michael, do you want to give us an introduction to the case and your argument, and then we'll let Paul take the government side and question you?
Sure. Well, the magistrate enforced the warrant, even though it was for emails stored in Ireland, because he said, you know, ECPA is ambiguous about whether warrants issued under the statute, the Stored Communications Act part of it, it's ambiguous about whether those warrants apply extraterritorially. And if the government couldn't use a warrant to get emails stored abroad, it would pose real difficulties for it because the MLAT process takes too long. What if there is no MLAT with the relevant country, etc.? And so he interpreted the act as applying extraterritorially. He also said that the search doesn't actually take place abroad where the emails are, but only in the U.S. where law enforcement will read the emails, which was a rather novel proposition. So Microsoft has appealed, and as you said, Verizon has filed an amicus brief, and more recently some other parties have as well, and we won't give those law firms free advertisement or Verizon's competitors. But our argument was basically, and so is Microsoft's, that there is a doctrine known as the presumption against extraterritoriality, and that is that says that unless Congress explicitly says that a statute shall apply to conduct abroad, it doesn't. And so if the magistrate found, as he did, that the statute is ambiguous, which actually it isn't, it's completely silent, then the presumption kicks in and the statute does not apply extraterritorially. There's also a related doctrine known as the Charming Betsy Doctrine, which says that, again, unless Congress is explicit, a court should interpret a statute in a way to make it consistent with the laws of nations, that is, to avoid a conflict of laws. And in this case, if Microsoft had to comply with the warrant, it could run afoul of EU privacy law and Irish privacy law, which may not permit it to turn over stored email content to the U.S. government based on a U.S. warrant. We also, in the Verizon brief, we emphasize the difficult position that the government's argument would put cloud providers and U.S.-owned cloud providers, because they'd be stuck between a rock and a hard place, having to comply with a U.S. warrant that would potentially put them afoul of European law. So they'd be found in violation of one law or another. Also, you know, since the Snowden affair, there has been a tremendous amount of bad press and inaccurate arguments saying that NSA can get data anywhere it's stored, particularly from U.S. companies. So you should use us, a good German company that's bound by German data protection law, so your information will be safer. If the government prevails in this case, it's just going to amp up that argument 100-fold, because now European competitors will be able to say not just that NSA can get your data if you store it with an American company, but so can the NYPD and the DC police and the LAPD. So there'll be lots more American actors able to get data. So I think there's a lot riding on this case, not just for Microsoft, not just for Verizon, but for U.S.-owned cloud companies as a whole. The other aspect of this, and then I'll let Paul step in and dispute everything I've said, is that, you know, this could lead to retaliation by other countries who say, okay, if the U.S. government thinks that it can get data stored anywhere in the world just by serving a warrant in the United States, then we're going to take the same approach. So you could get the Russian government saying, well, we don't like this dissident who's been saying bad things about Putin's policy in Ukraine, so we're going to investigate him for a crime in Russia, and so we're going to serve a warrant on Microsoft's affiliate in Russia, and we're going to get email stored in the United States. China could do the same thing. Germany could do the same thing. And suddenly you've got companies being served with warrants, or not even warrants, but just government orders where a warrant is not required. So you could see a real diminution of privacy, and you could see a tremendous conflict and difficulty imposed on companies that have to operate globally.
Yeah, that last one, we're already sliding toward that sort of a world, I think. The U.S. government has said, no, the law is the law where it's stored, at least when they're talking about letting people respond to foreign government orders. They've said, no, they have to go through the MLAT process. They have to come to us, and then we'll serve you with an order. But a lot of governments increasingly are getting fed up with that and have started to say, okay, while we're going through the MLAT process, how about your entire staff here in country spends the wait in jail? And that tends to force creativity on some of these companies.
You know, it's also going to become a big issue if the EU data protection regulation persists in its current form. Because, as you know, one of the provisions in at least the current draft says that a request from a foreign government, like the United States, for data of EU citizens that's stored in the EU, the company cannot comply with that order without the approval of a data protection official in the home country, which would turn even if Judge Francis's opinion were to hold and these search warrants were enforced, you'd have a situation where the home country data protection authority, at least for EU citizens, said that the provider was precluded from complying with the warrant without their blessing.
Well, and of course that's part of the reason why the government wants to be able to just serve Microsoft and get the stuff and nobody the wiser in Europe. You can understand the bureaucratic imperative, but where it leads is not completely comfortable.
Yeah, no, I mean, you've got to feel sympathy for companies that are subject to inconsistent, laws. I'm not sure I buy if we do this, it'll make the world worse argument, because I'm sort of with Stuart on the idea that the world is already getting worse, and the Chinese have not exactly demonstrated a great deal of respect for the mutuality principle. Ask Google about that.
I'm not aware of them having successfully induced U.S. companies to produce data from the U.S. That would be very hard to justify.
I think it would be hard to justify. I'm not sure that I share your lack of knowledge. But that's neither here nor there. I think, in the midst of essentially a trade war over privacy principles. It's just not in the least bit surprising to me that the U.S. government would think that its view of what privacy is should be the one that controls American companies that are domiciled in the United States, that take advantage of American corporation law, tax law, whatever, the protection of the American military in the end for what they want. I guess my question really, and this is an honest question because I don't, but wouldn't Microsoft have to respond if this were just a garden variety grand jury subpoena?
Yeah, and that's an argument that the government made, that subpoenas have for a long time been enforced to require a company in the U.S. to produce data that is within its possession, custody, or control, regardless of where it's stored. The difference here is that warrants traditionally have not applied extraterritorially. And so the question is, well, did the Stored Communications Act change that? Did Congress mean to expand the extraterritorial scope of search warrants to match that of subpoenas? And the answer is, in my view and in Verizon's view, no, it hasn't. It hasn't clearly expressed that policy judgment. And, you know, we make the case that Congress can weigh the pros and cons of the government's approach here and decide that it's worth it to enable prosecutors and law enforcement agencies in the U.S. to get data abroad more easily, despite the cost to American companies. But that's a decision Congress should make, not the executive branch, not a single magistrate sitting here in New York, because there are broad policy aspects to this that are appropriately made by the legislature.
Isn't that, I mean, not to put a fine point, but isn't that a puzzlingly anti-privacy oriented argument? I mean, you've essentially now conceded that the grand jury subpoena, which is issued upon a relevance standard and basically is as easy to secure as toilet paper in a supermarket, that would be okay, and that if Microsoft got one of those, they'd have to answer. But that a warrant, which at least has, you know, prior judicial review and is on a probable cause standard, which is, you know, not that hard, but certainly harder to match than a relevance standard, is not the way to go. And I would have thought that if I were privacy protective, I'd go the other way.
Well, EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, has filed a brief siding with Microsoft, and you know they're the official spokespeople for privacy. So I'll let them speak to that. But more seriously, you know, a subpoena has never been used to get customer data or to get the content of emails abroad, to my knowledge, and the government certainly hasn't cited a case. And so what we're dealing with here is the content of emails. And so while your argument, I think, would be correct if a subpoena could be used to get the content of emails or customer data as opposed to the business records of subpoena party.
Microsoft, if Microsoft were storing all of its internal emails and there were an antitrust investigation here, if then they had their emails in Ireland, it wouldn't take 2 seconds for the courts to say, no, cough them up. But I think the argument is there you're using something that is essentially an order to the person to produce their own stuff. A search warrant is you can break down the door and just take it. You're not asking for anybody to assist you. And in this case, the warrant is for stuff that is not a record of Microsoft.
It is. I mean, unless and until, you know, we kind of go away from the Smith versus Maryland paradigm, it is. I mean, you know, we've controlled it. It constitutionally it is. We've controlled it with the Stored Communications Act stuff. But, you know, I mean, I'm highly sympathetic to Microsoft, but as a business matter, they're between a rock and Iran.
So you'd be pleased to know that Orrin Kerr seems to be moving in your direction, saying, come on, how can it be that this protective warrant doesn't apply, but you know that subpoenas do? So I think that is going to be a feature of this argument from here on out. You agree?
But again, fundamentally, this isn't just about privacy. It isn't just about the difficult position that cloud companies are in, but it's about the rule of law. I mean, you've got these two judicial canons of construction that clearly apply here and that say Congress has to speak clearly if it wants a law to apply extraterritorially and in a way that's going to conflict with international law. So let Congress make the judgment, not a magistrate in New York.
All right. Well, I agree with you. That's a very strong legal argument, and it was overcome not so much with law as by the magistrate's incredulity that he couldn't order something coughed up from Ireland. But his policy judgment overcame his legal reasoning. We'll see whether which stands up when it gets to the district court and almost certainly the court of appeals. This issue is not going to get resolved short of a court of appeals, is my bet.
Just to jump up 50,000 feet, you know, we've talked before about how some of the longer lasting consequences in this country of Snowden and the leaks are going to be on the criminal side, not on the national security side at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see it in courtrooms and you see it in terms of DOJ's legislative priorities on the Hill and you see it in terms of their relationship with providers. And this is an example of that. That, you know, this is not, the merits of the legal issue aside, I think the brief that Michael wrote is right on the money as a matter of law. This is not an issue that has been raised by providers in the pre-Snowden era.
I think that's right there. You would not have, this would have been worked out in some relatively constructive and quiet fashion a year and a half ago.
This is not the first time the United States has sought content stored overseas from a provider. And this is just the first time they have made it.
Okay, on to other news. Michael's making news. I also made news last week. CSIS, Jim Lewis and I produced a report on the cost of cybercrime. Paul was a participant on the panel rolled out that report. We determined that the likely cost of cybercrime globally was $445 billion, roughly. I mean, really more like $350 to $550 as a range, but a very large number, a couple hundred thousand jobs at stake just in the United States. What I thought was most interesting is the staggering impact as a tax on innovation, where half the return from your R&D now is eaten up by the cost of cybercrime. And that is very troubling if you think that it's only constant R&D and innovation that sort of keeps us out of Malthus's clutches. A lot of interest, and I thought surprisingly little criticism of the number as overhyped. There used to be a lot of criticism of that sort, and increasingly people say, no, there really is a real loss here. And while you can't measure it the way the recording industry measures losses from file sharing, it is quite substantial.
Yeah, it is. I actually, what really struck me is that report is part and parcel of what I'm thinking is the theme of today's podcast, which is it's all an international problem. We've talked about China and IP theft and espionage. We talked about the conflict of laws between EU and US on privacy. Yet we're not going to solve cyber crime either from a uniquely American perspective. We have a lot to offer in terms of resources, knowledge, effort, but unless and until the government again takes the necessary steps to make to induce Russia not to be a safe haven anymore for cyber criminals or the Ukraine, that number's not going to go down. Indeed, one of the most interesting things, I read a side report from one of the threat in people, forget which one, that suggested that the amount of actual theft has gone down in the last 6 months because the cyber criminals in Russia and the Ukraine are busy engaged fighting each other over Crimea. And so they've kind of enlisted in the army, so they're off the books for a little bit in the criminality, which would be a really interesting way of thinking about how closely connected they are to their governments.
Yes, although it's a little scary because they're only going to be getting better.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it does suggest where the right answer is. It's not necessarily in traditional law enforcement efforts, though those will have a role. But if they're state-sponsored criminal theft or state-tolerated criminal theft, your answer is going to have to be at least partially through the states.
Yeah, which, of course, persuading them all that they have some stake in the current system is pretty difficult, considering that some of the biggest actors are North Korea and Iran, who don't have much of an economic stake in the current system.
I should say, shout out that it is a really good report, and Stuart and Jim Lewis have been brilliant at it, so go download it, read it, it's well worth the read.
Okay, and it's free.
So, by, it's free, yes.
That's right, it's the cheapest thing you'll get from cybercrime in the next year. Okay, speaking of criminal issues, there have been two decisions in the last week on what the law is that governs cyberspace. One, I think, is probably not so big a deal, the indication that Wi-Fi moochers have no expectation of privacy in the identity of their mooching computers. Michael, Jason looked at that, I think, right?
Yeah, it's not a particularly controversial decision, unlike the one that Michael will talk about in a moment. But the Third Circuit held last week that there's no Fourth Amendment violation when police use a device to identify someone mooching off someone else's Wi-Fi network to engage in criminal activity. In this case, it involved a man in Pittsburgh, or the Pittsburgh area, who was using his neighbor's unsecured Wi-Fi network without permission to download child pornography. And the police used a device and software to identify the freeloader and later found on his computer over 140 images and videos of child porn. The defendant argued that that evidence should be suppressed because the police used the device without a warrant, and he lost in the district court. He then entered a conditional plea, which allowed him to challenge the suppression motion, and was sentenced to 51 months, and he was unsuccessful in the Third Circuit as well. And the Third Circuit held that the use of the device wasn't a search under the Fourth Amendment because whatever subjective expectation of privacy he had, it wasn't one that society would recognize as reasonable. Since
well, because your Wi-Fi connection says, hey, it's me, please let me on, right? It's sort of hard to argue that you have an expectation of privacy in what you broadcast.
And he was actually trespassing because he wasn't supposed to be on that network in the first place.
Good point.
And they distinguished on those grounds the Kylo case, which is that 2001 case in which the law enforcement used a thermal imager to figure out that some marijuana growers were using heat lamps to grow marijuana in their house. And the court said that that was a search because the criminals were actually confining their activity to their home. Whereas in this case, as the court put it, this guy extended an invisible virtual arm out of his house to get onto the Wi-Fi network of his neighbor across the street.
He's in somebody's home.
Right. Exactly. This wasn't one that he had an expectation of privacy in. And then he deliberately went outside the protection of his home. The court also made the observation, which is right on the money, and sort of apropos to our discussion about how to get information from ISPs, that had he used his own router, the government would have been able to get this information directly from his ISP with a subpoena, and he shouldn't get elevated protection from law enforcement because he was trespassing on his neighbor's router. And the court basically drew the analogy to the drug sniffing dog, saying that they were detecting illegal signals coming from someone's luggage, and this was illegal signals coming from his home. The one thing that is interesting about the opinion is that the district court said that under Smith versus Maryland, the defendant had assumed the risk that the information would be turned over to law enforcement because he voluntarily turned that information over to a third party. And at least two of the judges in the Third Circuit panel were not willing to go that far. They said that they did suggest that certain information, like his MAC address and his IP address, was voluntarily turned over to the neighbor or to the neighbor's router, but that the signal strength, is actually what directed the police to his home, that was never actually possessed by the neighbor, by the third party, so it wasn't really voluntarily turned over. And he didn't assume the risk that would be detected. It was only through the use of the device that information could be obtained.
Which pushes you back toward Kylo, I guess.
It pushes you back toward Kylo, but then since he was outside of his own home and a trespasser, and that kind of trespassing is actually illegal under Pennsylvania state law, too. So he didn't have any reasonable expectation of privacy, however much he would have wished that he did.
Well, talking about reasonable expectation of privacy, I think you're right. The 11th Circuit decision about cell phone tower dumps is much more controversial, at least in my mind, and maybe more significant. Michael, you looked at the 11th Circuit decision, didn't you?
Yeah, U.S. v. Davis, which is an 11th Circuit decision authored by a D.C. Circuit judge, Sentell, who was...
Oh, yeah, Judge Sentell. I thought that was interesting, too.
Yeah, 11th Circuit is probably more common for judges to wear cowboy boots on the bench down there, so I think he probably fit right in. But in any case, this is an issue that has split the courts, whether the government needs a warrant to get cell site location data in order to track someone's location. Here a guy was convicted of robbery based in part on evidence that the police had gotten showing that he was nearby certain banks that had been robbed. And the way they did that was by getting his historical cell site location data from his cell phone provider. The government used a 2703D order, which requires less of a showing than probable cause under ECPA. And he moved to suppress the evidence, saying that a warrant's required, because just as with a GPS tracking device, this essentially the cell site location data serves as a tracking tool, and so you need to meet the same standard. And the 11th Circuit agreed. Even though in the U.S. v. Jones, the Supreme Court found you need a warrant for a GPS tracking device because there was a physical trespass on the person's car, here the court said that's really irrelevant. Here a person has a reasonable expectation of privacy that the police will not track his location using cell site location data because people don't voluntarily give their providers their cell site location data. That's an odd part of the ruling because, of course, people do voluntarily give their cell site location data. But what the court meant, I think, was that people don't realize this is happening. Unlike dialing a number, everybody realizes that when they dial a number, their cell phone company has to know what the number is in order to connect the call. But the court said, people don't realize that their phones transmit location data. And therefore they have a reasonable expectation of privacy.
How stupid do you have to be not to realize that you're driving down the highway? How do you think the phone company finds you to deliver the call to you? Because it knows where you are.
Yeah, no, I think that's right.
What phones
I think this is an area where
apps on them.
you know, I think the technology is still new enough. The use of the technology for law enforcement purposes has just not been percolating in the courts long enough that eventually I think judges' sense of what people's expectations are will change because things will become more common knowledge. But I think the case does show that Smith v. Maryland and the whole third-party doctrine is really on its way out or on its way towards being significantly limited. And the Supreme Court signaled that in Jones. I mean, Justice Sotomayor had a concurring opinion where she said explicitly that maybe it's time to reevaluate Smith v. Maryland. And the Alito opinion for four justices pretty much said the same thing, implicitly at least, that just because you turn over data to a third party or do something that's technically in public view doesn't necessarily mean that you forfeit your reasonable expectation to privacy.
I agree with you that it's been put in at issue. It's become like a discussion on ordinary blogs by people who know otherwise very little about the law. And the court is struggling with this. I cannot believe in the end when they get this issue argued to them that they'll be enthusiastic about getting rid of that because it opens up so many issues that they'll have to decide based on, well, do you think Judge Sentell realized that his location was known to the phone company? That kind of analysis is so temporally bound that they'll end up with, the Supreme Court having to resolve all of the issues. This will double their workload. Yeah.
Two quick points about this. The first is just a small sociological point that Sentell was on the district court, the court of appeals panel that decided Jones based on the mosaic theory. So this is basically his, I was right before, I don't care what the Supreme Court said, I'm gonna do it again until they tell me I'm absolutely wrong. And the second is that I would see a bigger distinction between the Alito and the Sotomayor pieces. Sotomayor is full bore against the third-party doctrine. Alito is really about big data problems and large-scale accumulations. And that's the line that I think that is going to be the interesting one going forward. Because if you blow through the third-party doctrine altogether, then you start calling into question whether or not the recording, the surreptitious recording by an informant of a conversation requires a search warrant because it's fundamentally also about what you expose to a third party and what your expectations of privacy are as to that third party, and I might have an implicit expectation of secrecy that you violate when you surreptitiously record me. So I think what's going to happen is the line's going to be drawn at the large data mosaic kind of idea, and where that line will be, I don't know exactly, but it'll be more than one, less than 1,000, and that's where it's going. And if that's where the line actually comes out, then Sentell will be proven by history to have been right.
You know, it's interesting, to Paul's point, if you read the opinion and you control F for the word mosaic, you will find it more than one time. and I totally agree with the way Paul characterized it. It's also, you know, Alito made another observation in Jones, which I think is perhaps the most important one, which is that these are issues that should be resolved and lines that should be drawn by Congress. And the prevailing view, if you look at the location privacy bills that have made their way through various stages of consideration in the Judiciary Committees, this view that Judge Sentell has seems to reflect the view on the Hill. I mean, it's almost generally politically plutonium for members of Congress to be seen as in favor of giving the government access to information. But there seems to be a view on the Hill, whether it'll ever be expressed in actual legislation, that this information should be protected the same way as actual GPS information. And, you know, it's worth noting that when it's longstanding practice of DOJ that to get GPS information from someone's phone, the real precision location information, you get a warrant. And there are a number of reasons for that. But one is, that's not information the person is voluntarily disclosing to a third party. That's information that you are requiring or forcing the provider to reach out and ping the person's phone to extract that data from the phone. There has to be a constitutionally significant difference between that and a situation where something that I agree with you, I think any reasonable person knows that the only way their call gets connected is because they're generally telling the phone company where they can be found. It is a moral victory for this defendant, though.
Only a moral victory, though, right? He's still going to jail.
He's still in jail for 160 years. He had a lot of stacked convictions for using a gun in furtherance of a violent crime. These were armed robberies that he committed. And the court upheld the conviction because they said the officers acted in good faith. based on the laws that existed at the time, so that the evidence was not suppressed. The defense remains in jail.
Actually, one other point is the perversity is that Alito says it should be done by Congress, but victories like this in the courts are going to take the heat off of Congress to act, and they're going to sit back and say, so long as the 11th Circuit and David Santel are taking care of it, why should I go to the trouble of passing a law?
Although we will end up putting more pressure on the Supreme Court now, because the Sixth Circuit and the Fifth Circuit have come out a different way. The Third Circuit reached what I think is the absurd conclusion that every judge can decide what the standard is for themselves, that even though the standard for historical cell site is specific and articulable facts, they said that a judge could, if he or she wanted to, require probable cause. So the more this conflict raises its head between different circuits, the more pressure is going to come to court.
Wow. Yeah, they can.
And you know, there's good
IQ tests and say, were you just too dumb to realize how cell phones work?
Well, regardless of whether the third party doctrine gets thrown out completely or retained in some fashion, there's going to be difficult line drawing, regardless of what the test is, whether it's a big data analysis, a third party doctrine analysis. The Supreme Court and lower courts in particular are going to constantly be faced with difficult line drawing questions.
All right. Well, I want to get to ICANN because nobody other than Paul actually knows anything about ICANN or has any interest in it. But let's do a lightning round on other developments. They got Guccifer or Guccifer. How do you pronounce that? The guy who outed the president as a painter of toes, right. Among other things. You read the indictment. Anything interesting there? He's a Romanian, right?
He's Romanian. He was a Romanian who actually just last week was sentenced to 4 years in prison for hacking accounts of Romanian government officials, including the head of the Romanian CIA.
Well,
so he's equal opportunity. A couple interesting things from the indictment. None of the victims are named, so sort of consistent with our conversation before about co-conspirators, but it's not hard to figure out who they are, and it's widely reported that one of them is the relative of both Presidents Bush. One is Colin Powell, and one is a former member of the Joint Chiefs. Guccifer also was believed to have hacked into the accounts of Leonardo DiCaprio and Steve Martin, which I think would be much more entertaining than the Bush accounts, but that wasn't part of this indictment. And it's not clear whether he will serve his time and then face extradition here, or whether DOJ will try to get him here. It is worth noting that, since there's not a lot of bipartisanship in this town, that during this administration, DOJ has gone after the hackers who hacked into Sarah Palin's email account, and now the hackers who added President Bush as a painter. So there's certainly equal opportunity.
God bless them, yes.
And I do want to just give a shout out to two prosecutors who brought the case, Peter Roman from CSIP, used to work for me, and Ryan Dickey from the Eastern District of Virginia, are two of the best cybercrime prosecutors in the country, and they did very well.
Terrific. Okay. The FCC chairman gave a speech. I was there. Were you there too, Paul? Cybersecurity and the FCC's role in cybersecurity. He gave a shout out to Admiral Simpson and Cleet Johnson, whom you may remember from the Senate Intelligence Committee, who's now chief counsel for public safety, the Public Safety Bureau. It was a good speech, but a little hard to parse, I thought. We expect a lot from the private sector. We're not going to settle for just kind of a mood music from them. And we're watching, and we want them to do the right thing because otherwise it could be bad for them. But what the otherwise really boiled down to was hard to identify. And exactly what he wanted them to do was, I thought, up in the air. Clearly, he took up the Jenikowski initiatives from a year or two ago, revived or name-checked the Cybersecurity Risk Industry Council or whatever it is, the CISRIC. So he made it clear he takes it seriously. He wants more from Admiral Simpson at Public Safety. But I thought he left a lot of the content to be developed later.
I read this as a me too, right? The FTC has been moving forward very aggressively and successfully in their efforts to use the NIST framework as a ground for
judging unfair business practices of consumer organizations. The SEC has been moving forward quite aggressively. They've announced an audit of broker-dealers against the NIST cybersecurity framework. They about a year and a half ago, they put down the materiality requirements for disclosures, which have so far been a bit of a paper tiger, but are likely to become more now that we have a framework against which to judge materiality. So this was the FCC raising its hand and saying, hey, we're a commission too. You're going to have to listen to us. Frankly, they probably have more direct and cognizant jurisdiction over these matters than the other two groups. I mean, I would say that on a security, it would be DHS sorts of things. But if you're going to move over to the civilian side, I would have thought it was the FCC that would be leading the charge instead of the following Me Too-ism. So my guess is that this is part and parcel with the other thing that you didn't talk about was the announcement at the presidential level that they didn't think they needed more regulatory authority because they had ample stuff to bring it forward.
And regulating wasn't the right answer anyway.
Right. So now this is all part of a nudge, but it's a big nudge, and nudge is really just code for covert force, in my judgment. And so we'll see where it is. I mean, this is all part of a large scale development that is essentially going to wind up 5 years from now with the U.S. government being the standard setter of first resort.
I think that's right. All of this is sort of coming right up to the line on doing some regulation and not, but making it clear that if something goes really wrong, some aggressive action is going to be taken. That's my guess about how the positioning is.
Watch the incentives. Things that people will get for doing whatever it is that they want that we can couch not as as sticks, but as carrots. Things like DOD procurement, preferences and things like that.
Or data breach lawsuits.
Yes.
Before we get to ICANN, one more topic. West Virginia has a new data breach doctrine that sounded like it might be pretty aggressive, but I didn't read it closely enough, Michael. I hope you did. Oh, sorry, Jason.
Oh, so I actually think when you read it closely, it's
not as bad as it seems.
I mean, as watchers of data breach class action know, standing has been a significant obstacle to plaintiffs trying to bring data breach lawsuits, especially if they can't show actual identity theft as opposed to the possibility of future identity theft. The West Virginia Court of Appeals granted standing to a class of people whose medical information was exposed, potentially exposed, although not actually stolen. But what makes it somewhat limited in its impact is that the court said that mere risk of future identity theft was not enough to establish standing, but there are some particular causes of action under West Virginia law that made it possible to go forward. One is a cause of action for breach of the duty of confidentiality of medical information. And the breach of that duty, even in the absence of an injury, was enough to give standing.
That's a big deal.
If that doctrine catches on
elsewhere, you don't have to show any harm at all. You just say, there was a duty, it was breached, I want money.
Well, and the same is true of the other cause of action, which is a cause of action for invasion of privacy. And the court said the violation of that right gives rise to a common law cause of action for damages, even without alleging special damages from the particular privacy invasion. I think the sound you hear is class action lawyers packing their cars for the West Virginia.
Oh, yeah. Because you can surely put together a class. Everybody's in exactly the same position. Did they owe you a duty? Well, yes, I was a patient. And that's the beginning and the end of the particularized inquiry into your facts.
And at least for cases involving medical information, I think you'll see a lot more of these cases filed in West Virginia, although, you know, query whether West Virginia wants an influx of class action lawyers to boost their tourism, but I think that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, actually they might. Okay, well let's move on to ICANN because, Paul, if you weren't here, we would never talk about it. You've written a paper for Heritage on
what
conservatives should think about, ICANN, right?
Right, yeah. It's released today. It should be live even as we speak. Actually, I think it went live at 1 o'clock, so there you go.
Okay.
And I don't know when this is actually going to be broadcast.
Tomorrow.
Well, then it's live. So ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. They're the guys who keep the address book for the Internet and wind up in the end making sure that when you type in Microsoft.com, it resolves to an IP address that points you to a server out in Bellingham, Washington, not for some guy who manufactures small little soft cloths in France or something like that. Fundamentally, they're not totally significant. To find Microsoft, you're much more likely to use a search engine. I mean, you don't go to socks.com for socks. You Google socks and you pull up the first sets of socks. On the other hand, names like that have some real significance. There's a big fight going on right now between Amazon, the company, and the Brazil and Peruvian governments over who's going to get the .amazon, generic top-level domain. And you can see why Brazil would want it. You can see why the bookseller would want it as well. More importantly, however, I think that the, role of ICANN as a kind of international organization is going to have to be, pache all of the things we've been talking about, a model for where we're going to have to drive some internet governance for the whole host of other issues. I'm not so worried about who makes policy for naming issues. I'm worried about who makes policy for content control, who makes policy for criminal prosecutions globally against cyber criminals and cooperation, who makes policy for anti-spam regulation, which is a subterfuge for content control. And right now, the leading contenders are nobody, which is why we have the privacy wars that we're having with the EU, or the International Telecommunications Union, which is a UN organization, one nation, one vote, where Libya gets the same say as the United States. That's not a successful long-term model, in my judgment. So you're
suggesting that ICANN needs to be successful so that we can have an ICANN for content control or spam control?
Everything is going to be internationalized in the end. And provided that it's internationalized in the right way, that's good for America, good for the internet, open, free, not subject to authoritarian control. I expect fully that in the end, the network's going to bifurcate into two institutions, an authoritarian network and a liberal network. The question is going to be that unmatched middle in the Brazils and the Indias and the South Africas. Are they going to go with the authoritarian network, or are they going to go with the Western network? I want them in the Western network because that makes the Western network more valuable to us, and that means giving them some form of role. And so where we are right now is that the Obama administration has proposed transitioning some policy control to ICANN, this Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, and getting the United States out of the business. The paper we've published suggests what the terms of that transition should be. Things like making ICANN auditable, having an independent judicial function so that adverse decisions from ICANN can be appealed and are not just the decision of a randomly selected board of governors that can't be challenged. Continually making ICANN subject to suit so that they can't say we're an international organization who's immune from process outside of these.
You don't mind having government officials tell them what to do as long as the government officials wear robes?
I think it would be best to be a private sector arbitration group like the International Court for Domestic for Dispute Resolution, ICDR. So yes, no, I don't want it to be a government one. So long as there's no government people on the board, it's a tough needle to thread. But my question for those who were, some conservatives say, no, the U.S. should hold on to the network.
For forever.
And that's just not gonna happen. And the reason it's not gonna happen is because we're down to 11% of the people on the network right now, and it's only gonna get smaller because we've maxed out. 95% of Americans have network access. The rest of the world is much less. So, as we move towards 7 billion people attached to the network, the 300 million Americans who are attached are going to be smaller percentage. We cannot keep exclusive control of this for ourselves for forever. Want to guide it so that it becomes a kind of responsive, what we would recognize as an ordered liberty kind of institution with audits and inspector general. My motto for this is Stuart Baker for IG for the Internet.
I'm waiting. I'm holding out for Chief Privacy Skeptic.
Oh, Chief Privacy Skeptic. But, I mean, that's actually a really great one. We can go down the road of a large-scale fight over privacy with Europe.
Right.
Right. And that will be to the disbenefit of Microsoft, to the disbenefit of European countries that want to keep some of their data here in the United States or want to access American customers. In the same way that, we're having tax wars with the Swiss right now and all those folks. That's just a loser proposition. In the end, what I'd like to see is the development of a construct for international governments and the network that excludes government control to the maximum extent practical. We can't eliminate it altogether unless we eliminate governments altogether, which isn't happening, but excludes it to the maximum extent practical and allows people with interests, corporations, users. I'd even let EFF and the other NGOs into the room to express their view, to have an effective say. Maybe that's overly optimistic for me, but I think the failure mode is horrible.
That is sort of what ICANN does. I mean, they have boatloads. It's like the American Bar Association. You can just get lost in their bureaucracy, and it's participatory as can be.
Well, that's actually its problem right now, is the participatory democracy is so poorly organized and poorly built that it devolves essentially to the rule of the board of directors. Whatever they say goes, because they collect 14,000 comments, and they say, oh, these are the 12 that are really the right ones to make it. So we need, what I think they need is something that's a little more representative, rather than kind of the pluralistic democracy by voice, to a more representative form of governance that actually represents stakeholders and that has an architecture that calls them to account when they diverge from that. May not happen.
Well, and it is my observation that ICANN has done some things that are fairly dramatic, but the things that really drive them to action are things that are in the financial interest of ICANN, right? So it's clearly in their financial interest to sell a lot of new names, mm-hmm. and even if it creates a dispute between Brazil and Amazon.com, because selling Amazon or .Amazon is worth money to ICANN. And it does seem to me that just saying, well, we ought to have an international body with lots of people talking doesn't really fully take account of the fact that everybody's got a set of incentives.
It's always all about the Benjamins, right? It's all about precisely why stuff like an audit are essential, so that there's a transparency to where the money goes. I don't mind ICANN having money so much. What I would mind is if it turned out that the money was lining people's pockets instead of being put back into the domain for increasing broadband capability in Africa or something like that.
Well, a lot of it goes to flying more people in for the meetings.
Well, the possibility of no governance at all strikes me as just not feasible in the long run. It worked. So you need a governance structure. And it's got to be something that the majority are going to agree on, or we're going to break up into more than two networks. We're going to break up into four or eight. And for my mind, money, the most significant plus value of the network is the way in which it enhances productivity and efficiency because of its ubiquity.
All right, so a good report, and everybody should go download it and read
it. It's from heritage.org.
14, 15 pages, right?
Oh, yeah. Something like that.
Okay, thank you. Before we finish up, we usually give everybody an opportunity to plug their latest activities, speeches, books, writings. You have an endless stream of them. I know you have the Great Courses course on cybersecurity and another one coming up, right?
Mm-hmm. If you want to hear 18 half-hour lectures on cybersecurity, you can get Thinking About Cybersecurity from Cybercrime to Cyber Warfare from the Great Courses, which is part of the teaching company. It's easy. It's relatively inexpensive and amusing. If you want to see the more academic treatment, you can buy the book, Cyber Warfare, How Conflicts in Cyberspace Are Challenging America and Changing the World, from Prager Press. The new teaching company project won't be out for another 9 months or so, but you can wait for it because it's called The Surveillance State. At least that's its working title. My subtitle is How I Plan to Try and Monetize the pain from Edward Snowden by making money explaining him to everybody else, but that's the best I can do.
We'll have you back before 9 months have passed so that you can plug it closer to the publication date.
Yeah.
Michael, any speeches or writings coming up?
Tomorrow I'm speaking at the PLI Summit on Data Privacy here in New York, covering hot topics in data privacy and security litigation.
Okay. And I'm going to be down at the Federal Circuit Bar Association in North Carolina on Saturday giving a talk on contractor responsibilities for cybersecurity and probably talking about cyber war strategy as well. And then I'm going to be talking to the Aspen Ideas Festival the first week of July, where I will...
Tough life, Aspen in July. Yeah.
That is going to be tough, and but I'll make it as tough as I can because I'm going to be giving a talk on why privacy is mostly a moral panic. So it'll be fun right until I give the talk, and after that I'll be ostracized by all the good people of Aspen. So thank you all. This has been episode 24 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. I want to thank Michael Vadas, Jason Weinstein, and especially Paul Rosenzweig. We hope you'll join us again next week when we'll be speaking to Ralph Langner of the Langner Group. He's the guy who discovered Stuxnet and analyzed it, and he is now, speaking of monetizing, giving a whole bunch of advice on how to protect industrial control systems against hacks. If you tune in next week, we will once again provide insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and privacy.